It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickard is off for the holiday. Today is not only Thanksgiving here in America, it's also the first day of Hanukkah. And our next guest says Jewish Americans celebrate the holiday unlike any other place in the world. Joining us to discuss her new book, Hanukkah in America, A History, is Diane Ashton, professor of religion studies at Rowan University. Diane, thanks for spending time on the holidays with us.
Oh, I'm very glad to be with you.
How important of a holiday, setting aside the United States for a minute, how important a holiday is Hanukkah in Judaism?
Hanukkah is ranked as a minor festival. It's certainly something that everyone is aware of and that we are supposed to celebrate, but it is not one of the more important occasions in the Jewish calendar.
And what does it commemorate?
It commemorates the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem in 164 BCE after it had been retaken from people, the country that had conquered ancient Judea, tried to destroy the temple. Jewish forces retook it and rededicated it.
So how did the holiday take on such significance here in the United States if it's a relatively minor festival the rest of the world and throughout most of history?
Well, Hanukkah has the good fortune to occur at a time of the year when the rest of American culture is having a very good time. And so Hanukkah allows Jews to enjoy themselves because we're told to sing and rejoice at Hanukkah. And we can do this by doing something Jewish and at the same time participate in what American culture is also doing. The rest of American society is also celebrating and having a joyous time with their families, and we can do the same with ours.
Was there a point where there was a conscious effort to say, hey, everybody else is having fun with Christmas, let's make a bigger deal, a bigger celebration out of Hanukkah?
Yes. In fact, for more than 100 years, rabbis and Jewish newspaper editors and religious leaders began saying to parents, give your children gifts at Hanukkah so that they can be happy to be Jewish children at this time of year when they see their Christian playmates having a good time being Christian.
Was there
So this was something that was very definitely advocated.
Was there concern that maybe some Jewish children in particular were being kind of lured into the Christmas celebration?
I think the concern was more that they were unhappy being Jewish, and people wanted their children to be happy and to have warm, fond memories created that they would be able to look back on when they became adults and would be then happy to carry on with their own children. And so it would help them to not only be happy as children, but would cement their commitment to Judaism all through their lives.
I remember around Christmas sometimes being jealous of my Jewish cousins who got presents every day for a few days leading up to Christmas and then Christmas presents from the other side of the family. But was gift-giving always a part of Hanukkah tradition, or was that an innovation here in the United States?
Oh, it's part of the U.S. Holidays are big business in the U.S. And it's very hard not to have some kind of consumerism involved in an American holiday. So gift-giving emerged really in the United States.
And when did that start? When did gift-giving become a part of the Hanukkah tradition?
In the late 19th century, at the same time that Christmas really took off, when we had department stores growing very large and becoming very easily available to people, and shopping becoming an important part of women's lives and mothers' lives, Jews participated in that same cultural trend and took to the shopping and the buying and the domestic holidays along with the rest of American culture.
The time period you're talking about, if I recall correctly, is a time of a big boom in immigration of Jewish people from Eastern Europe, countries around Eastern Europe in particular. Was this kind of building up of Hanukkah and maybe other holidays a way to bring people together from diverse parts of Europe in a new country?
Well, it's interesting because what we see in Yiddish newspapers that were read by the new immigrants, people would say that they were buying presents for their children at Hanukkah, and we're very proud that they could do that because it showed that they were becoming successful in America. They were taking on American behaviors, and they could afford to buy their children presents. So this was something that gave new immigrants great satisfaction.
For a lot of immigrant groups, for just about every immigrant group, I think there's a tension between the desire to fit in, assimilate even, versus maintaining the traditions, the old ways, whatever they may have been. Was that tension there in the late 19th century into the early 20th century when it came to Hanukkah?
Yes, very much so. And I think, in fact, I think it's somewhat still around. I think there are still people who feel very ambivalent about how commercial Hanukkah has become, that Hanukkah has become more important because it coincides with the Christmas season. And there are people who really are uncomfortable with that. But that's American culture. That's the culture we're living in.
One thing that I was a little surprised this year that Hanukkah happened this early on Thanksgiving. I didn't realize that the timing was quite that wide-ranging. How is that? I know this is going outside of America and your book a little, but how is that timing calculated?
Well, the Jewish calendar is basically a lunar calendar with interpolations to make sure that the holidays stay basically in the same season that they're supposed to be in. But within that, they move quite a lot relative to the U.S. calendar, which is a straight solar calendar. So there's some floating there.
Kind of like Easter, I assume Passover is a similar thing? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that consumerism, buying stuff, is a huge part of just about any American holiday. So is food. How important is food to Hanukkah celebrations?
Food is important to every Jewish occasion. A good many Jewish holidays have some component where there's a meal at home. And so Hanukkah is no different. But at Hanukkah, the important foods are fried. And they can be anything, any kind of food, as long as it's fried, because that symbolizes the miracle of the oil that occurred when the temple was rededicated. A small amount of oil for the menorahs in the temple lasted for 8 days until more could be made. And this was seen as a miracle. And so we commemorate that miracle by eating fried foods. And what that food is can vary tremendously depending on what part of the world you're living in. In Israel, people eat jelly donuts. In Eastern Europe, where most Jews in the U.S. came from, people ate potato pancakes. And many, many Jews in America eat potato pancakes. People from Central and South America will eat fried plantains or yucca pancakes. And, of course, the recipes can change for those pancakes quite a lot. There's a men's club at a Fort Worth, Texas synagogue that sells latkes every Hanukkah. And you can buy those latkes either with a traditional potato and onion recipe or with a more Mexican-flavored recipe. So what you do with the food can really change.
We'll get into maybe some more of the food and other things about Hanukkah in America in a few minutes. We're talking to Diane Ashton. She's author of the book Hanukkah in America, A History. And you can join in. We're live here on the holiday at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about Hanukkah is celebrated, or if you are celebrating today, what do you do? What's an important part of your annual Hanukkah tradition? And are you combining Hanukkah and Thanksgiving? Thanks, Hanukkah. Gannon will help me out there in a minute. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Thanksgiving, I think that's it. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we continue our conversation with Diane Ashton. She's the author of the book Hanukkah in America, A History. You can join in, still time for you, at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about Hanukkah, how it's celebrated, what it means, or if you are kicking off your celebration today, let us know some of your favorite memories, a cherished tradition, what your family is doing right now. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Diane, you mentioned the menorah, and that's an important part, I know, of the Hanukkah celebration. You mentioned briefly the historical influence, but Joe, what kind of things have Jews in America done with the menorah as part of the celebration?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, because, of course, the menorah itself really doesn't matter so much. It's it's a holder for the lights. It's the lights that matter. So the style of the menorah can be almost anything and has become almost anything. So we see menorahs that are really beautiful art objects, and we see menorahs that are just very simple tin things that are sometimes given away to school children. There are menorahs made by the Disney company that have Disney characters in them. There are menorahs that show scenes of New York City. There are menorahs that have the Statue of Liberty or have sports equipment images. I mean, they can be almost anything. And again, because the holiday is supposed to be a joyous time, they are part of the fun, really, particularly if it's a menorah that's given to a child who will use it. Then the menorah will often reflect whatever the child is interested in.
So it's become, in some ways, a symbol of the holiday analogous to maybe the Christmas tree or a Christmas wreath, it sounds like.
Well, in a sense, you're right, in that it's part of something that reflects the family's tastes.
And the candles themselves, though, you say are the more important religious aspect of it. Do people still include the candles along with their menorah? It isn't just a menorah doing nothing there for the most part.
Right, but the candles are just small candles. They burn for about half an hour. They're thin. So the time that the menorah is actually lighted is actually only about half an hour. And during that time, you're not supposed to do any work. So that's just great. You have a good half an hour of time to sing, to play games, to talk with your family and friends. It's a perfect way in a dark evening to remember a miracle and to have a good time.
In studying the history of Hanukkah in America, was there anything that surprised you that you hadn't known going in?
Almost everything. I think one of the things that really impressed me was how the story of the Maccabees was so important in making Hanukkah a meaningful event in different eras, because Jews have been in North America since 1654, and it was really in the 19th century that rabbis began to talk about the Maccabees as great leaders. And their debates over leadership and the Maccabees and the importance of the Maccabees really started making the whole story of Hanukkah something that was much more commonly familiar to people in the U.S. than it had been previously. But in each era of American Jewish life, the Maccabees were understood in a different way. They were understood always as people who were brave and courageous, but what that entailed and what it was they were fighting for was always modified to reflect whatever Jews felt was their current challenge. So the Maccabees, they would talk about the Maccabees fighting for religious freedom. They would talk about the Maccabees' courage in overcoming oppressors who were trying to wipe them out. So, for instance, during World War II, the Maccabees' courage and ultimate victory over an army that was trying to destroy Jews and Judaism, you can imagine
Wow.
how important that image was.
Wow. And how is that tale told today? What kind of concerns does it reflect nowadays?
I think these days the idea of religious freedom, which has been consistently a theme, is still one of the most important ideas about Hanukkah, that the Maccabees fought for religious freedom.
When I think about Jewish America, I have to step back and think about how diverse that is, how many different communities, secular, Orthodox, and all points in between. How much diversity is there in the way those groups mark Hanukkah?
Well, that's pretty interesting because there is tremendous diversity in Jewish life in America these days. You're quite right. And some people will, well, the Chabad Lubavitch, I think, is probably the most distinctive. These people are really dedicated to trying to get America's Jews to be more observant, because most American Jews are certainly not as religiously observant as the Chabad Lubavitch would like them to be. And so this is a group that puts out these very large electric menorahs in public squares. People have seen them probably all over the country at this point. And so they will have Hanukkah celebrations in a public square. They'll serve latkes to people, and they'll sing, and they'll light these very large, very public menorahs. That's very distinctive, and they're really meant to be a kind of beacon to other Jews in the area to remind them to light their own Hanukkah candles. That's probably the most distinctive.
I wonder, since the United States is such a unique place in the way it celebrates Hanukkah, when Jewish people from other countries go here or Americans go elsewhere, is there kind of a culture shock? Like, what are you doing, or why aren't you celebrating this more?
I think American Jews who go to other countries are surprised that Hanukkah is not as commercial an event as it is here. But again, that's because this is a highly commercial season. And I think any country would be hard-pressed to be as commercialized as an American. The time between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I think our commercial culture is more intense than anybody's.
And are Jews from other countries surprised when they come here and see how commercial
yes.
it is and the hullabaloo
yes.
about it? It's
yes.
just Hanukkah.
Right.
Okay. Well, food, as we mentioned, a big part of the holiday. But this year, the first day of Hanukkah is today, also Thanksgiving. And there's been a lot of writing, positive and negative, about how these two holidays are being integrated or kept separate. How is that Thanksgiving collision affecting Jewish Americans this year?
I think people are kind of amazed by it being a big fuss. But the two holidays are both about giving thanks, so you don't have a conceptual problem. I think the only question is, you know, when do you eat your Hanukkah food, and when do you eat your Thanksgiving food, or are we going to do this together? I've seen recipes for deep-fried turkeys or sweet potato latkes, and that's fine. There's absolutely no problem with that from Judaism's perspective.
I think it would be great to have turkey, some gravy on potato pancakes, the potato pancakes you mentioned earlier. That sounds like a great combination.
Yeah,
what is
I
on,
think so.
What's on your table tonight or earlier today, depending on your timing?
Actually, it's right now. It's totally Thanksgiving. I'll be having a Hanukkah party at my house on Saturday night, and then we'll eat the latkes.
Okay, latkes, and what else is on the menu for Saturday?
Oh, it's a potluck, so I'm not sure what's going to be coming.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. A lot of fun. I've learned a lot about Hanukkah and the way we celebrate it in America.
Well, thanks for having me. Have a good Thanksgiving.
You too, and have a great Hanukkah. That was Diane Ashton. She's professor of religion studies at Rowan University. Her new book is Hanukkah in America, A History. There's still more to come here on Central Time. We're going to look at Thanksgiving Day shopping. A lot of retailers are opening them up, the big stores, the big chain stores in particular, hoping to get a jump on Black Friday shopping, get those holiday sales dollars coming in. Our guest, not happy about it, says, nope, it's optional. They should stay closed. The workers should stay home. And she's encouraging customers to not go there. Maybe you're listening on your way there right now, though. We'll talk about that coming up. And we'll be back tomorrow on Central Time with a look at the latest news. We're thankful for you listening, certainly, and we hope you turn in tomorrow. We'll have great advice on photography. We'll have a book, If Mayors Ruled the World, What the World Can Learn from Mayors of Big Cities and How They May Take the Lead in Solving the World's Problems. Check us out today or anytime. We're Central Time on WPR on Facebook. You can tweet us. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Central Time WPR. We're Central Time WPR on Twitter. Stick around. More to come on Central Time coming up after the news. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy Thanksgiving and welcome to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about a Wisconsin baseball player who our guest says may have been the unluckiest player in the history of the sport. First, we're just hours away from major retailers opening up their doors to Thanksgiving Day shoppers looking to get a jump on Black Friday. Actually, one retailer has been open since 6 this morning. Plans to stay open until 11 tomorrow, a total span of 41 hours. It's a growing trend among retail stores, but not everyone is happy about it, including our next guest, who says the best thing you can do is just stay home. I'm joined now by Ellen Galinsky. She's the co-founder and president of the Families and Work Institute. She wrote a piece for Time called Don't Go Shopping on Thanksgiving, Just Don't. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
So why shouldn't stores be opening their doors on Thanksgiving?
I think the issue is not all stores or all services. There are emergency services we need. There are some people who need to go out to eat on Thanksgiving. There are people who want to go to the movies as a family on Thanksgiving. So I think the point that I was making was starting your Christmas shopping or your holiday shopping early. That seems to me to be much more discretionary than things that you do for family fun or emergency services that you may need.
So it's optional, not mandatory or holiday-based. So, but stores are saying, hey, there are people who want to shop here. We don't want to turn away money coming in the doors. Why shouldn't they open on Thursday?
This article that I posted on Time, Inc. has been the top-running article for the for the first, for the 5-6 days since it's been posted, and has 100, more than 100 comments, and I've read the comments, and most people seem to feel that the issue is one of choice, that the particular issue is that some people are forced to work and don't really want to work on Thanksgiving. If you get bonuses or special pay, that's one thing, but a lot of stores that are opening don't seem to be doing that, according to the responses that I've gotten. The thing that I feel, though, is a larger issue, which is that the way we work best is to have some time for rest and recovery, some time away from work, and we have an image of work right now as running a marathon, just run, never stop. Well, if you're training for a marathon, you take time for rest and recovery so that you can run all those in the New York Marathon, 26, 27 miles. And we don't have, with technology and with the way we're working these days, we don't have time off. And our data show that people are not working very well when they're just always on. So having time for other things in your life, whether it's family, whether it's creating traditions with your children, whether it's with friends, whatever it is that you do that gives you a break seems to be important. And we, little by little, work is spilling over and taking up most of our time. We find that the people who have some time off, a vacation day, holidays, and vacations are people are taking much less time and they're wrapping around weekends. But the people who have time off have much better health, sleep better, are more creative at work, make fewer mistakes at work. So I'm arguing that we step back and look at the way work is spilling over into our home life. This is more about the workers than about the shoppers.
So it sounds like you're saying that's not having that time off, whether it's Thanksgiving or vacations, isn't just bad for the workers. It sounds like you're saying that it might be bad for the employers, too, if the workers are coming in bad shape because they have no time off.
It is bad for the employers because people tend to blow up, you know, get angry at work if they have had no time off. They tend to make mistakes. They tend not to be as creative and innovative and engaged. So, yes, it is not good for employers. And workload is an issue that has been on the agenda. We did our first study on overwork in 2003 and have done other ones over the years. We find about a third of employees feel seriously overworked with no time to step back and think about what they're doing, overwhelmed by everything that they have to do. And it's been like the elephant in the room. Employers haven't begun to grapple with it because they can't imagine, like the stores that are opening, being productive unless they're open all the, you know, unless they're asking people to work all the time everywhere. And this year we give an award for excellence in employer flexibility and effectiveness through the Sloan Foundation, the Sloan Award for excellence in workplace effectiveness and flexibility, it's called. This year, among our almost 300 winners, we had about 10% who were actually beginning to tackle the issue of workload by looking at who's never taking any time off and encouraging them to, by cross-training so that all the people don't have to do the same job, by giving people choices, by that sort of thing. So, Finally, employers are beginning to recognize that overwork isn't good for them.
So by this time, obviously, stores have long since made their decision on whether to be open on Thanksgiving Day. Your message today, I'm guessing, is to consumers. What do you want them to be thinking about as they're deciding if and when to go shopping?
Think about how this will feel in 5 years. What kind of Thanksgiving do you want to have? On the emails to people, some people are saying, I want to go shopping. That's my idea of a holiday.
But it's not mine.
But my view, not mine either. My view is that think back, particularly if you're going to be with friends or families or do something, what kind of traditions, what will you remember about this day in 5 years, and vote with your feet.
And not go shopping.
Not go shopping.
So, but if I'm a brick-and-mortar retailer, I'm saying, you know, Amazon isn't shutting down today. They never close their doors. The things that are really threatening my business are going to keep running, and maybe people just stay home and shop online. I've got to compete with that somehow, and maybe that means asking my workers to make a sacrifice and come in on a holiday.
Well, that's interesting because you've got different brick-and-mortar retailers behaving in different ways. Costco is one that has always paid higher wages, that has been more flexible, has been much more of an employer-friendly kind of a business. And their business is doing well versus some of the businesses that are falling into this work all the time everywhere sort of notion. So what I'm saying to all of us is let's step back and think about how work is affecting our lives off the job. And it can enhance our lives off the job, but if we're just completely worn out, it's not going to be good for our personal life, and it's not going to be good for our employers.
Seems like this Thanksgiving Day shopping has been on the rise for the last few years, really. Do you think we've hit a turnaround point where we won't see more stores opening on Thanksgiving and maybe some will be rolling it back?
I'm not. If the business isn't very good, that will speak for itself. I mean, we know that work is ever encroaching on our lives, and people may think it's a small thing, but who would have thought that professionals would be working nights and weekends a long time ago, and look how that turned out.
All right, Ellen, thank you so much, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Have a wonderful time.
Ellen Galinsky is the co-founder and president of the Families and Work Institute. Her piece, Don't Go Shopping on Thanksgiving, is on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up next, we'll hear about a Wisconsin baseball player who barely missed playing in the World Series on four separate occasions. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday would have been the 93rd birthday of Johnny Schmitz. If you remember Johnny Schmitz, it's likely you were either a Chicago Cubs fan or a resident of Wausau, Wisconsin. In his day, Schmitz was a pitching phenomenon, according to our guest, Gerald Poder, professor of American Studies at Lawrence University. Gerald, welcome to the show.
Good to be on.
So Johnny Schmitz, he was born in Wausau in 1910, made it into the big leagues at 18. How unusual was that for the time?
That was pretty unusual. Actually, he was born in 1920. He's from Wausau, born in 1920, and he made his debut at the age of 18 for the Cubs, and actually went on to have a pretty solid major league career. His nickname was Bear Tracks, and the reason for that is that his feet were huge. He wasn't necessarily a very tall man, but yeah, I guess sometimes people of average height have huge feet. And he took a photograph when he was young, sort of with his spikes up in the air, like, you know, leaning on something. And someone said, "My God, you've got these huge feet. They're like bear tracks." And so his nickname was Bear Tracks throughout his major league career.
I guess you could do worse for a nickname.
In baseball, you can do much worse.
Yeah. Now, I gather he batted right, pitched left, also a little out of the ordinary?
Very, very out of the ordinary. I can only think of a couple of major leaguers who batted right-handed and threw left-handed, whether they were pitchers or outfielders. That testifies to some ambidexterity, I think, in his genetic makeup, because that is very, very rare.
He enlisted in the military during World War II. His career started in 1938. So, like almost everyone else, he went to war. How did that affect his career when he came back?
Johnny Schmitz, unfortunately, I have to say, is one of the most luckless Major League Baseball players, perhaps in the history of the game. And I say that because he managed to miss out on playing in the World Series a number of times, actually four separate times, and the first time was because he was in the military. He was in the military between 1943 and 1945, and he was Cubs property. The last pennant that the Chicago Cubs won, as many Cubs fans or all Cubs fans know, is 1945. So Schmitz, who got back to the majors with the Cubs in 46, missed out on playing in the World Series in 1945 because of his military service.
So that's one missed World Series. How did he miss other ones?
Here are the others, and they're really excruciating. He toils with the Cubs until 1951, and the Cubs are a very bad team by the late 40s. But in 1951, he gets a huge break. He's traded to the Brooklyn Dodgers, who were in first place in 1951. And once again, it looks like Schmitz is going to play in the World Series. But as it turns out, the Dodgers, who had a 13.5 game lead in August in 1951 to the Giants, ended up losing that lead, tying on the last day of the pennant race in 1951. Two out of three game playoff. They lose the first, they win the second, or they're tied 1-1 in games going to the third game. The Dodgers are up 4-1 in the bottom of the ninth to the Giants in the third and final playoff game, and they lose on Bobby Thompson's famous home run. And Schmitz is in the Dodgers' dugout. Having been liberated from the Cubs, he thinks he's going to the World Series, but no, Bobby Thompson in the last inning, after his team has lost a 13.5 game lead, and he's not going to the World Series. However, there's still time for him. There's still an opportunity for him, and it comes the next year. He is still with the Dodgers in 1952, so had he stayed with the Dodgers, who won the pennant in 1952, he would have gone to the World Series. But no, he's sold to another team, so he misses out with the Dodgers. But the team that he gets sold to, I'm not making this up, is the Yankees. So
right, sure thing there.
He has yet another opportunity to be in the World Series. And in fact, the Yankees in 1952 went on to win the World Series. But no, in September of 52, he gets traded from the Yankees to the Reds. So he misses out on the World Series again. But there's still hope. There's still one more opportunity, because in the offseason of 52-53, Schmitz gets reacquired by the Yankees. So, once again, maybe he's going to the World Series. But no, in the 53 season, a season that the Yankees would win the World Series. He's put on waivers and claimed by the Washington Senators in 1953, a team as far from the World Series as you can possibly be, and he never gets to the World Series.
But he was a good pitcher, though, right?
He was a good pitcher on bad teams, and that's sort of almost like a term of art. He made the All-Star team twice in 46 and 48. He led the league in strikeouts 1 year in 46, and that's, you know, that's a pretty impressive achievement with all the great pitchers coming back from the war, that, you know, that he was a strikeout leader. In those days, there weren't huge strikeout numbers. His strikeout number to lead the league, I think, was in the 130s. So it's not like, you know, he struck out 300 batters, but, you know, he did lead the league, and he was a very solid, dependable starter for the Cubs, unfortunately, on bad Cubs teams.
Wow. Almost like he was cursed to never make it to the World Series.
I think he was cursed like the Cubs. I think he was cursed like the Cubs. In fact, in many ways, he symbolically represents, I think, the futility of the Chicago Cubs in, you know, during that time and afterwards.
So he retires in, I think, the late 50s. What did he do for the next half century?
Well, you know, he was a good Wisconsin boy, you know, born and raised in Wausau, and that's where he came back to after his career ended. He was a groundskeeper at a golf course and basically kept a very low profile until he died only, you know, only 2 years ago. By all reports, he was, you know, again, very typical of Wisconsin, a very modest man, an unassuming man. Certainly, you know, he played briefly in New York for the Dodgers and Yankees. But he was not a New York kind of personality.
And he ends up, and how did this happen, in a painting by Norman Rockwell?
In a painting by Norman Rockwell. And you know, again, if you're a Cubs fan, this is almost the symbol of futility. Norman Rockwell decides in 1948 that he wants to do a baseball painting. And Rockwell lives in New England, so he heads to Boston, where the Cubs are playing a doubleheader with the Boston Braves, then Boston Braves. And what Rockwell would do is he would pose people before the game, or pose people preliminarily, take photographs and work from that. And he ends up painting four Chicago Cubs and a bat boy in what became a famous painting, and maybe some of our listeners have seen it. It's called The Dugout, and it shows four forlorn Chicago Cubs sort of staring out on the field, and just to the right, in the sort of the right-hand corner of the painting, is Johnny Schmitz. The others are the manager, Charlie Grimm, Bob Rush, and Rube Walker, and they're just sort of staring out forlornly at the field. And I think even then, only 3 years removed from their pennant in 1945, Rockwell understood that the Cubs were almost like a cursed franchise. And Schmitz, I think Schmitz symbolized that. And actually, in the game, there was a doubleheader that day. It was in May 1948. And after Rockwell set the paintings up, the Cubs went out and lost both games of the doubleheader. And one of the players in the painting, Rube Walker, was hit in the head by a ball.
Wow. So did that painting end up becoming a symbol for Cubs fans over the years?
I think it is. Scott Simon, who is an NPR essayist is known for basically linking that painting. I think it hangs in his office, I think he said. linking that painting with the futility of the Cubs, and there really is a sad sack quality to this painting. The fans are booing them. It's a road, you know, it's the Boston crowd, so they're booing them, and they look like awful things are happening to them. And if I were a Cubs fan and I was looking to symbolize or encapsulate the futility of that team over decades and decades, you can't do any better than this Norman Rockwell in the dugout a painting.
Back to Wausau. Does the city of Wausau look at Johnny Schmitz as a local legend?
Very definitely. And again, I think that He goes back to Warsaw. He doesn't big time it. You know, just as politicians get what we call Potomac fever and refuse to go home to their districts after their careers end and they stay in Washington, many players end up living in, you know, the more glamorous cities that they played in. Schmitz wasn't like that. He ended his career and there was no question where he was going to go. He was going to go back to Warsaw, where he grew up, where he lived, where he knew everyone. And he was, I think, a bit of a local legend for all these years. But he lived for over a half century after he retired. But he wasn't, again, he wasn't the kind of guy to try to draw attention to himself. So he lived pretty quietly. I think he was the kind of person, if you wanted to talk to him about baseball, he would talk to you, but he wouldn't sort of strut into, you know, stores or taverns and say, "I'm Johnny Schmitz."
All right, Gerald, thank you so much for sharing his story with us today.
My pleasure.
Gerald Poder is a professor of American Studies at Lawrence University. If you have a suggestion for a Wisconsin legend, someone from Wisconsin you'd like to hear more about, call our hotline, 855-683-5422. I'm Rob Ferret, flying solo today. Veronica Rickert is off. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.